How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
WBEZ is supported by Impact Grants Chicago. Over 400 women come together in a unique model of collective giving. Each member contributes $1,000, and together those donations grow into $100,000 grants for Chicago nonprofits that address critical challenges across the city. By pooling resources, individual gifts multiply into greater impact. Listeners can learn more about Impact Grants Chicago and past grant recipients at impactgrantschicago.org/join2025.
It's been almost 5 years since the start of lockdowns in response to COVID-19. Remember this?
To avoid the loss of potentially tens of thousands of lives, we must enact an immediate stay-at-home order for the state of Illinois.
That feels like both a million years ago and just like yesterday. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. For some, the pandemic can feel like a distant memory, but for others, especially long COVID patients, the pandemic never really went away. Dr. Jerry Krishnan is a professor of medicine and public health at the University of Illinois Chicago. He studies long COVID. Amy Pope is a long COVID patient and a participant in a UIC study about the disease. They began by explaining long COVID and what it is. Here's Dr. Krishnan.
I think it's always useful sometimes to kind of begin at the beginning, which is first, what is SARS-CoV-2? SARS-CoV-2 is a respiratory virus. It's a new respiratory virus that was identified as the cause of pneumonia-like illnesses back in December of 2019. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out about half the people who are infected with SARS-CoV-2 go on to develop a disease. They get sick. They have fever, cough, headache, fatigue. And that's what we call COVID-19, which is the illness related to SARS-CoV-2. That now takes us up to long COVID. Long COVID essentially is a chronic condition that lasts 3 or more months after having been infected with SARS-CoV-2. Long COVID is the term we now prefer to use. There are other terms that people used before, such as long haul syndrome, mm-hmm. even a technical sounding word, set of words called post-acute sequelae of SARS-CoV-2. Thank goodness we came up with the term long COVID.
I'm so happy you did.
Yeah.
Much easier. When I ask something like how is it diagnosed or identified, is it just that 3 month period that you were talking about a moment ago?
Yeah.
Presenting those symptoms of the virus for 3 months?
Exactly. So it's basically either new symptoms or a real big change in their symptoms compared to, you know, how people felt before the SARS-CoV-2 infection. So right now, long COVID is a clinical diagnosis based on what patients tell us, and it's based on their symptoms. There are no tests yet, no laboratory tests yet for long COVID. We expect that to be coming as a lot of the research is going on, but right now it's based on symptoms.
Yeah. So what percentage of people with COVID would you say develop long COVID?
Absolutely. So the answer to that question really depends on which SARS-CoV-2 infections they had. So way back at the very beginning, it's probably around 20%, maybe 30% of people who had a SARS-CoV-2 went on to develop long COVID. Nowadays, it's closer to about 5%, maybe 6% of people.
Okay.
So which virus makes a big difference in terms of what proportion go on to develop long COVID?
And are some folks more susceptible to long COVID than others?
Absolutely. So again, part of it is depends on which SARS-CoV-2 infection you had. We know that women are more likely to develop long COVID compared to men. We also know individuals who had more severe disease. So for example, if you're hospitalized for SARS-CoV-2 infection, more likely, although even milder disease can do that as well. And then we also know age matters. So if you're an adult, mm-hmm. you have a much higher risk of long COVID compared to children. Children, it's roughly about a 1% risk. Adult, somewhere around 5 to 10%.
Okay. Amy, let's bring you in now. What's your story?
I had the original COVID virus mm-hmm. Before vaccines were available. I would say I had a mild infection. I was at home. No pulmonary issues at all.
Okay.
Just all the other symptoms.
The aches, the flu.
The flu, the headache. Mm-hmm. And I just never got well. I expected after 2 weeks to, you know, sort of slowly recover. And I started Googling, why wasn't I feeling well after having COVID? And at that time, it was just starting to be talked about by Dr. Fauci, who was saying, oh, there might be a syndrome after this. And I was like, okay, glad to hear that.
How long had it been going on for you before you were thinking, let me head to Google because this feels abnormally long?
Probably a couple weeks, yeah, 2-3 weeks after the initial 2 weeks, okay. I started thinking something was wrong with me.
What were you still feeling at the time? All of the original symptoms?
All of the original symptoms minus the fever. Okay. So I was still fatigued. I was still having headaches. My whole body was still aching. I was dizzy. Yeah, all of the original things.
Yeah, and that was almost 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. What about now? What are your symptoms now?
I still have the same set of symptoms. They just come and go and are more mild than they were back then.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor, what other symptoms are we missing here? So Amy talked about the fatigue. We talked about the flu-like symptoms. Does anything else present itself when you have long COVID?
Yeah. So in addition to Amy's symptoms, which are really characteristics of long COVID, another one I would add in there is something called post-exertional malaise. And that sounds very technical, but what it is relatively minor amount of either mental exertion or physical exertion, something you could easily have done in the past, just completely drains you and you actually feel sick. And usually about 12 to 24 hours later, you just got to crawl into bed. You just feel totally wiped out. So post-exertional malaise is another symptom that comes up. I would also add something that we call brain fog, which is difficulty concentrating, difficulty remembering, difficulty paying attention. That's another key feature. And then just to add to what Amy said earlier, sometimes people have a real sense that their heart is racing or that they feel dizzy and may even pass out when they're trying to stand up, something that's related to your autonomic nervous system, the dizziness.
Right.
And then finally, shortness of breath and cough are also common symptoms with long COVID. And so is sleep, by the way, either feeling very sleepy or not being able to fall asleep. Sleep disturbance is incredibly common with long COVID.
These symptoms vary so much. I mean, you were nodding through some of them, Amy. Was he sort of jogging your memory there?
Oh, totally.
About some others that impacted you?
It's something that I've lived with for so long that I don't even name them anymore.
Yeah, but makes total sense.
All of those things.
So how does that impact treatment then, doctor, when the range is so wide of symptoms here?
Yeah, and so I think the first thing to point out is there's hope here, even right now as we're trying to figure all this out. The first is to see someone who knows about long COVID and can put a label to it, then that's the first step. So hopefully this program is raising the profile of this condition and people can determine, hey, maybe this is something I should get checked out. I think the second component is because long COVID can affect any organ system, mm-hmm. It's important to seek medical attention in a program that has a multidisciplinary clinic that has pulmonologists, you know, neurologists, cardiologists, psychiatrists.
Yes.
Because you have to sort of put the pieces together to figure out, is this long COVID?
Or you can go see all the experts.
You can see all the experts, and they can work together, too. They can talk to each other and say, you know, what do you want to do with this particular patient that she's describing this but not that? Sort of for them to work with each other to come up with a coordinated plan. The third is that even today, as we're waiting again for the cure or the treatment that is specific to long COVID, we now can treat a lot of the complications associated with long COVID. For example, turns out diabetes is more common in people with long COVID. You actually develop difficulty really handling blood sugar.
Wow.
And we know now how to treat diabetes. So we don't have to wait, you know, until all the research is done. We can treat the diabetes. Turns out that sleep apnea is more common with long COVID. And that's something we know how to treat, you know, today.
Yes.
So I think right now we're focused on addressing the complications of long COVID. And while we wait for all of the research studies that are underway, including the clinical trials, to come up with more definitive treatments for long COVID overall.
Yeah. Well, here's the big question, doctor. Can people recover from this?
Great question. That's the question every patient asks me. That's a question that comes up. So I think here's what we know, and this is what the benefit of research is, that we know now that most people do not get long COVID. Most people who have COVID don't develop long COVID.
Correct.
That's important. Number two, we know that most people with long COVID do get better. It's only about 5% to 10% of individuals with long COVID that go on to develop sufficient persistent symptoms where they're disabled. So it's not everyone, but there is a substantial number of people. What I would say is that if you continue to have long COVID symptoms at 6 months after the original infection, then only about 1 in 5 of that group then go on to fully recover.
Okay.
So this is one, this is something like we're learning as we go. But if you continue to have long COVID after 6 months, then again, only about 1 in 5 will go on to recovery. That's something to keep in mind right now.
Talk to us a bit more about your journey with this, Amy, and how else your experience has maybe changed over time.
Actually, becoming a participant in the long COVID study at UIC helped me be able to actually see something on paper that was about me specifically, some actual test results, some people to talk to that actually deal with this every day. It can be very isolating because it doesn't affect, it affects millions of people worldwide, but it may not be in your small circle.
Right, right. How was that in the beginning when you were trying to maybe tell friends and family about how you had been feeling and what your doctors were saying at the time?
It's been polarizing. It still is.
Tell me more.
Well, we don't look sick particularly, and that can be tricky. Some of us do, but I don't particularly, and I work full-time now. I've recovered quite a bit. I'm not 100%, but I'm one of the lucky ones.
Yeah. What made you want to participate in the study?
Actually, I just wanted to help advance the science. I thought I had this illness. I had some information that I could share about what was happening with myself and my body, and it was important to me.
Yeah. What is the state of long COVID funding and research right now, Doctor?
Yes. Thanks so much for asking that question. I think that the good news is that none of the long COVID research studies that we're part of the recovery initiatives have been cut. And in fact, there have been funding allocated to expand the number of clinical trials that we're going to be doing with long COVID. So I think as we look at the future of funding for long COVID, we can only respond to what we're seeing on the ground. And on the ground, there's a lot of planning underway to expand the number of clinical trials in long COVID. Mm-hmm. And that's really how Amy and I actually started to talk about what can we do together is that, you know, as a researcher and as a doctor, I certainly have some experience relevant here, but really it's Amy and patients like Amy that can help us point the way about what is it we need to be focused on.
Yeah.
And so I think as we look forward now, we have developed a working group with patients to make sure that the studies that we're doing are addressing their real needs.
Mm-hmm. What questions would you say still need to be answered about long COVID?
Yeah, so there's several key questions. Number one is we know that long COVID is not one disease. It seems to be different in different people. So we need to understand what's going on in their body that makes long COVID, you know, really primarily affect certain organs in some people and other people it just looks different. Mm-hmm. So we need to understand more about the mechanisms of long COVID. And there's multiple studies that have been funded now to look at this. So I think we're going to learn more in the coming months and years about this.
Yeah.
The second is we need treatments. There are specific to long COVID. And that's why I'm really excited that the National Institutes of Health has really put a commitment towards moving forward with clinical trials and really expanding the number of clinical trials in the coming months and years. So I think there's a really bright future there. The third, and this is one that is kind of a specter that's all hanging in our heads as researchers and as physicians, and in some cases patients, is, you know, we have to draw a little bit on what we've learned in the HIV pandemic as well. So HIV, as you know, affected millions of people worldwide, and, you know, lots of treatments were available, and now we've converted what was a uniformly fatal disease into a manageable chronic condition. But we now know also that individuals with HIV sometimes go on to develop other chronic conditions. So we need to really understand the longer term implications of having long COVID. So that's the third element of what we need to do.
I'd love to hear from you both on this. What do people still not understand, you think, the general public about long COVID? What misconceptions would you want to clear up? You want to go first, Amy?
I would say that people have a misunderstanding of in general, that people are, that COVID exists, that people are not only sick with it for 2 weeks, that people do go on to have, and it's multiple different issues, as Dr. Krishnan said. And so in general, there can be, as I mentioned earlier, because some of us don't look ill, there can be some question about whether is this real? Are we making
this all up? Did you run into people not believing you?
Yes, I did. I still do. I encounter them regularly.
What's that like?
I just tell them my lived experience, and it's up to them if they want to, you know, accept that or not. I just ask them to go with the science.
Misconceptions, doctor? I mean, things that come to mind, for instance, there's talk about blood clots and, you know, whether that is an actual symptom of long COVID or if it's something from the vaccine. Have you heard about that talk?
Yeah, I mean, I think that long COVID can be because of either small blood clots or bigger blood clots. And that's why I think we need to continue the work we're doing to figure out what's causing long COVID. But to add to what Amy just said, I think one, long COVID is real. Absolutely. It's a medical condition. Second, it's diagnosable. We now have criteria for diagnosis. Third, we can address many of the complications now, even as we're waiting for the ultimate treatments. And the fourth is there's a lot of research happening. We haven't forgotten about long COVID. And I think that we look forward to working with everyone, including patients, to do the studies that are necessary to help them get better.
Is any of the funding needed for that research under threat right now? I'm thinking about the Trump administration being in the White House. Are you seeing any effects here on what that might do for long COVID patients in their future?
Yeah, so I can only talk about what I'm hearing in the press just like everyone else's and what I'm seeing regarding, you know, the actions taken as it relates to the studies that are going on right now. And I think the good news is both Secretary of Health Kennedy and the NIH nominee, NIH director nominee, Jay Bhattacharya, have said publicly that they support long COVID research, including clinical trials.
Okay.
Number two, the research that's going on right now for the recovery initiative, we're moving ahead just so we had planned to do previous to the change in administration. And I think that these give me hope and a sense that we're moving forward with long COVID, and we look forward to working with the new administration on chronic illnesses overall, including long COVID.
We've got just about a minute here. Amy, what do you want to say to folks listening? You've got the ear of people listening now. They're hearing directly from someone who is dealing with this. What would you want to say?
I would want to say that if it's affecting you personally, if you feel you have long COVID, I would definitely recommend that you get some medical help. It's important that your primary care physician understands exactly what your particular symptoms are so that they can guide you in the right direction to get some relief from those symptoms while we wait for the answers.
We'll leave it there. Amy Pope's a long COVID patient who participated in a UIC study about the disease and is helping with an upcoming study. And Dr. Jerry Krishnan is professor of medicine and public health at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Going through something difficult together is a very different experience than when going through it alone. As we continue to discuss long COVID, nearly 5 years after Illinois locked down to slow down the spread of the virus, we turn to people who are reaching out, creating community, and providing support. Shamir Sweeney is a long COVID patient and director of the Black Long COVID Experience. Mike Bialacek is a social worker who works with lung transplant recipients and long hauler support group leader at Northwestern University. Mike started us off with how he got involved in this work.
So I've been running support groups at Northwestern, primarily with the lung transplant program, for the better part of the past decade. And one of the transplant pulmonologists on our team is also one of the co-directors of the Comprehensive COVID Center. And so Dr. Sala reached out to me to see if I'd be interested in running a support group, really based on feedback from patients that were coming to the clinic that were looking to connect with fellow lung haulers in terms of not just emotional support, but really kind of navigating what resources are available for coping with it.
Yeah, tell me more about what you're hearing from the participants.
It's really been an amazing experience. We've built quite a community of folks that are dealing with kind of every aspect of their life being affected by long COVID. Physically, emotionally, socially, financially, spiritually, existentially.
Really?
It really impacts every part of a person's identity for some of them.
More than just, you know, some of the symptoms we talked about earlier with the doctor, right? The memory loss and the flu-like symptoms and things like that. It's going much further than that, it sounds like.
I think this kind of chronic condition that affected people that were primarily quite healthy and very high functioning is a different experience than maybe other types of situations. And especially something like COVID that unfortunately has been so divisive, politicized, et cetera. For these folks, the experience of going from being really high functioning to being nearly disabled or disabled because of this is a particularly unique situation.
And you've got some core members participating here?
We have a group, I'd say, of maybe 15 to 20 folks that come pretty much every month. And then we have a rotating group of new patients and people that are maybe coming back to us.
Oh, wow. Shamir, let's talk more about your situation. When we last talked, it was, I think, November 2022, so almost 2.5 years ago. How have you been?
You know, there have been a lot of changes in my life. Of course, as you know, I mentioned just getting married, and now I am a resident of New York instead of Maryland. And I've been able to, as you mentioned before, become the owner and the director of the Black Long COVID Experience, which allows me to turn my focus on creating educational, cultural and emotional and, support for Black long COVID communities. Anybody can be a part of it, though. So I wouldn't call what I'm doing a social group, but it's just an invitation to educate, motivate, and inspire Black long COVID communities on how to advocate for their health in the healthcare system and how to fight for long COVID care and treatment while also engaging in activities that are culturally relevant to Black people and also things that are fun. Last year, we were able to put on a virtual prom for long COVID and ME/CFS groups. And we call that the teal reveal, because as you know, the long COVID color is teal. And so I'm very excited about what I can do and what others of us can do in order to bring awareness, a different kind of unique, creative form of awareness about long COVID to the communities who look like me and even those who don't.
I want to dig a little bit deeper into the Black long COVID experience, Shamir, for folks who might be hearing that for the first time altogether. I remember you telling your story about, you know, a Black woman doctor who you said believed you, right? And that's when you actually received your formal clinical diagnosis. Tell us more about what that did for you.
You know, it did not come without a challenge or a difficulty, but I was able to change my whole life based upon that long COVID diagnosis that I received from Johns Hopkins. She believed me, but she would not put it in writing. So I was able to talk to her, her superiors, bosses above her. And we all agreed after reading my story and, sharing some insights that I did have, in fact, long COVID. And so because of that, I was able to not only share my story even more because it was validated by a doctor, but I was also able to receive Social Security disability insurance. I was able to continue receiving the rest of my employer disability, long-term disability insurance, and medically retire from being a teacher, which really sucked. But at the same time, there have been a lot of different open doors for me because of that. So it literally changed my life. Mm-hmm. But now I'm afraid again.
Why?
I'm afraid again because, as you know, in the news and in the administration, there is talk about stripping us of our Social Security benefits. And I get $1,700 a month, and I cannot afford to lose not one dime of that. And that is my fear. I am a woman who believes in also contributing to my household. We don't have any gender roles in my house. So I also contribute to my household by paying the energy bills, by paying for the Wi-Fi, the internet. And if I lose any part of my disability insurance, I lose an ability to take care of things in my home. Right. And so I really can't afford to. And so that's why I've been encouraging people, even virtually, to continue to protest and fight for their right for care, and also fight to really acknowledge long COVID, because it's not something that has gone away. In fact, it has gotten worse for so many of us since 2020.
Goodness, Mike, what comes to mind as you listen to this? I know you're hearing conversations among not just the core members, but folks who are coming in brand new to your group. Are they having these types of discussions about, like, you know, not being believed and maybe just fears with our current administration, just our current times?
Absolutely. So much of what was just said is descriptive of so many people's experience, with the first hurdle being believed, validated, and normalized. And I think for this diagnosis in particular, there's so many layers to that. There's close family and friends who may have misinterpretations or misinformation about what this is. Beyond that, you have the medical profession, which unfortunately there are physicians, nurses, and other professionals that have a difficult time, because this was such an evolving science, kind of accepting symptoms the way they were being described, and patients really needing to find ways to advocate for themselves. And what our group really does is there is a space where people can share tips and strategies and success stories for how to advocate for themselves, not just with medical professionals, but how to navigate the disability system, which is already complex enough,
right,
much less for a new diagnosis. And so what I'm hearing in this story is the importance of finding ways to advocate for one another in a community outside of those professional channels, and navigate the emotional coping side, but also just navigate the resources and how to best utilize them. So we hope that our group's really empowering to give people examples of how much quality of life can be improved in some situations.
You've even talked to our producer about how heartening it is on your end to see that resilience in the folks that come to you.
We do a lot of resilience building in the group, and a lot of that is bearing witness to people's stories. The situations that people are in are so fluid, and they're such roller coasters, and they affect so many aspects of their lives. And I walk away from every group feeling so much more positive than I did before that group started, because I'm reminded of the power of human empathy and compassion for each other and meeting each other where we're at. And I'm really amazed by what the folks in our group have been able to accomplish despite these challenges.
Shamir, how important is building community? And how do you do it? How do you go about it?
Building community is everything. I think that, you know, I hear Mike talking and I agree with everything that he's saying about resilience. But, you know, I still like to pose the question, while I do agree with being resilient, you know, I do still question why we have to be so resilient, and somehow in that resiliency, has it caused people to overlook long COVID as a, you know, in general. But one thing I always encourage is, because I was one of the first Black women to tell my story, I think it was easier for me to make community and to gain community, because I went places that other people would not go. You know, I was one of the first Black women who entered Body Politic, the long COVID support group. I was one of the first Black women to say on Twitter, hey, this is happening to me, and I understand what you're saying. And so I think that people gravitated towards me because I always tell my story in a very transparent and passionate way.
Yeah.
It never changes. I still want the same things I wanted 5 years ago for myself and for so many other people. I also build community, as I said. As a former teacher, I had to learn in Baltimore City how to create long-lasting lesson plans that would be imparted in my students' minds. And I also take that same attitude and that same charisma and creativity, and I use that to engage with folks on social media, mm-hmm. On Substack now and other things. Last week, for Black History Month, I created a 10-day platform where people were encouraged to participate with the prompts. And at the end of the 10 days, I created a bingo game for the Black Long COVID community and whoever wanted to support.
Yeah.
And we were able to raise $125 to give to a Long COVID kid, Jaron Keaton, in Charlotte, North Carolina, who had gotten sick again because of her Long COVID experience. And mm-hmm. so I'm really proud that not only do I talk the talk, I also walk the walk.
Right.
And that was an important evolution for me to make.
Yeah.
It's not just enough to say, you know, white people aren't doing enough, or there's racism or there's sexism in Long COVID care. I wanted to be the first example of somebody who reached out to community in the way that I know how to do it just now virtually.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking of all the challenges here that folks are facing, Mike. And I remember earlier you mentioned that your group has been open about facing spiritual impacts and existentially they're struggling. Say more on that.
Identity is such a complicated and multifaceted thing, and we put so much stock into things that we take for granted until they're taken away from us or they're diminished. And I think changes in one's cognitive and physical abilities reflect on how they interact with the world and interact with the people in their life. And so the question of why me? Why was I in this small percentage of people that ended up with, something that's this disabling speaks to, you know, the nature of suffering in the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been, you know, inundated by suffering and grief since COVID happened 5 years ago. And as a nation and as a community, I don't think we ever dealt with it openly or in a healthy way. And I think all of that spills into individual people's experiences as well.
What are your hopes then for the future?
My hopes are that we strike a balance between finding ways to adapt to changes that might be long-term or even permanent without giving up on finding treatment that becomes a cure, and that we find a balance between fighting for change and access to resources across all populations while also looking to ourselves and acknowledging what is not in our control and what is, and how much of our energy we can put into how we respond to these circumstances instead of wishing that they were different.
We'll have to leave it there. We've been talking to Mike Bielacik, who's a lung transplant social worker and long hauler support group leader at Northwestern University, and Shamir Sweeney, who's a long COVID patient, as well as director of the Black Long COVID Experience. We appreciate you both.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Micah Yasin. It was edited by Dan Tucker and mixed by Ari Mejia. To never miss an episode, make sure you subscribe wherever you listen or find us at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.